Good morning, everyone. We're continuing now with our discussion of living intuitively. Let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. We are deeply sincere in our desire to live in harmony with your will. We become lost and confused in our own desires and delusions, but your bright light will always show us the way. Help us to be receptive, to be clear, to be courageous, that we may follow your footsteps into our true home with thee. Om, peace. Amen. So yesterday I was talking about act on what you know, and I ended up with a rather long story all about my moving to Ananda and the different forces that were at play there. I think that that was a very dramatic and interesting, well, interesting to me, of course, because it's my life. We're always so interested in our own lives of the principle, but I think the principle can be illustrated also in less dramatic terms, and it might be helpful to do so. I was, as I was saying that, I'm going to riff off to the side for a little bit. When one first starts on the spiritual path, when I first started, and most people, it's a huge project of self-understanding and self-exploration. There's just so many dimensions of our own nature and our own past and past lives that are influencing us, but are obscure. And there's a it's both interesting and I think helpful to learn a lot about yourself. You know, this is where psychics and astrologers often are really quite helpful. I put astrologers and psychics in two different categories. Swamiji himself wrote a book about astrology and often consulted with astrologers, but he was careful to speak to those whose intuition he had come to trust and whose values were consistent with his own. Because like in any field, there's a wide variety of orientations. The same would be for those with psychic ability. Merely because someone has some outside the rational level ability to perceive, it's important to know who you're talking to and to use your own intuition in such things. The point of all of that, though, was not really that, except that I threw it out there, so I had to explain it. It's just like at certain times, the specific reality of what's influencing us is very important, because otherwise we can't get our minds around it. At least that's what I've found. I just can't get my mind around what my reactions are about, and if I can either intuit or sometimes friends could help me create a story, and whether that story was actually literally true or apocryphal, oftentimes having a story really helps me understand myself better and helps me understand the dynamics of what I'm going through. The difference between what I'm saying between psychics and astrologers, if the horoscope is read well, then we're looking at planetary influences. The astrological pattern that you see in the sky, if it can be read correctly, is actually a reflection of the pattern in the chakras. So you can actually discern what the play of energy is in your chakras, which is an exact pattern of your past karma that brought you right to this moment. And sometimes explaining it in terms of planetary influences, again, just it makes it comprehensible. Suddenly you see different aspects of your nature working together or working in opposition, which can give you clues. I remember quite recently an astrologer friend described a combination that I've been struggling with my whole life. No one had ever articulated it for me, between projected anxiety and then the too much commitment to what is really only a projection. And he said very sweetly, I loved it. He said, this is not a good combination. And if you don't learn to work with it better, you're going to be born with it again. And that was a tremendous incentive. And it articulated something that I had never been able to grasp quite so clearly. And stories about the past. I had a psychic tell me once that, quote, I helped start the French Revolution. I don't actually know if that's true or not, but what it told me is that I have used the persuasive gift I have to bring people to lesser ideals. And I have a karmic obligation now to correct that wrong by bringing people to the truest ideals. Swamiji himself said that a lot of his necessity to explain the teachings so much was because he himself had been, quote, eaten up with doubts in the past. And it was like a karmic imbalance that he had to now correct within himself, and almost, you might say, universally. He had projected doubts. Perhaps he persuaded people to doubt and to wrong attitudes. Now he had to fix it. So all of those things can be helpful. I had, you know, the whole thing about the French Revolution. Very recently, I mean, I have another point that I'm getting to here. I had just put that out of my mind. It could be true. It's apocryphal, if not true, because I have a revolutionary zeal. And I went once, my own friends, right after we bought our church in 1994, they sent me to the city of Palo Alto to talk about what signage would be allowed. And I was put into the hands of a tiny twerp. And I know that's not a nice thing to say. I was put in the hands of a tiny twerp who tried to persuade me that they had more power over me than we had over ourselves. You can see my attitude. This was a few decades ago, but still, I was so angry at being having this twerp of a bureaucrat dictate my life to me. I really had to get out of the office. I was enraged. It was really wild. I can be hot-headed, but this was of another order of magnitude. Like, I wanted to burn down the building. So I thought to myself, oh, yeah, this is, I get this. I remember this. And of course, then I went back to my friends and I said, what could you possibly have been thinking to send me to talk to bureaucrats at the city of Palo Alto? And of course, no one ever, ever, ever made that mistake again. It was complete madness. There were, you know, 10 people in our Sangha who could, you know, win them rather than execute them, which is what my guillotine them was. I'm just chatting. You'll have to just put up with it. And then somewhere, not too long ago, I read about this woman who had actually been at the beginning. This was a historical figure in France at the time of the revolution, who had supported the revolution at the beginning, but then realized that she was terribly wrong, and then spent the rest of the time trying to correct her error. Now, I'm not at all saying that I was that woman, but I thought, oh yeah, I could see that. You know, just in a moment of anger, of white hot frustration with some twerp of an aristocrat or whatever it was. I'm not sure. I think she might have ended up being executed. It doesn't really matter. But you see all these patterns, and it could be who you are. Now, the whole point I was trying to make here was, at a certain point, however, even though I've just given you recent examples, at a certain point, however, all karma becomes generic. That's how I think about it, which is something disturbs my peace. And it causes my judgment to become warped in favor of whatever emotions are running wild. And it becomes what I have sometimes thought of as a game of King of the Mountain, which I only played a few times as a child, but where somebody is holding a certain spot, sometimes at the top of a hill, and the game is just to try to drag that person off the top of the mountain so you can have the top of the mountain. And that's really all there is to the game. And that's all there is to the game, which is I'm trying to hold my peace and my karmic inclinations, my samskaras, and my karma is trying to drag me off of my peace. And my job is just to hunker down and hold on. And it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what uniforms they're wearing. It doesn't matter what arguments they're using. It's just generic. It's that something is trying to persuade you to move away from the center of light. Don't do it, because it really doesn't serve you to do it. Now, I guess this actually does relate a little bit to what I'm talking about today, which is, you know, the idea and the way that we're now talking about intuition is to be steadfast in your commitment to your ideals. And the more clear you are about what your values are and what your ideals are, the more powerfully you can live according to that vibration, which brings you into the center of calm feeling, which puts you where you want to be. Now, what I started yesterday and I'd like to finish today is that, and this is also the theme since I've been reorienting this, that living intuitively is not as dramatic or as unusual as people sometimes make it. And yes, those sorts of things do happen, you know, where there's the voice in the night. But even when the voice in the night comes, it's not that unusual. It's just the way things are. Okay, I'm going to go again a little bit off from where I was thinking, but I think this is important. A number of years ago, on one of our pilgrimage tours to India, different Ananda entities over the last 20 years have taken groups to India, and everybody meets sadhus or makes discoveries, and we exchange information. And a lot of us use some of the same tour guides, especially a wonderful man named Mahavir. And so when he gets another Ananda group, he'll introduce us to what has been discovered by those who came before. So one of the trips that we went, it may have even been the last or the next to the last trip in that context, our friends in Italy had met a sadhu who lived above Badrinath, and his name was Boxwala Baba. And box actually meant box in English, Boxwala, because he, even though most of the sadhus come down from the mountain when the snow starts, even the deity, they move it from 12,000 feet down, from 10,000 feet down to 7,000 feet to a winter temple. And most of Badrinath closes down because the snows are just too deep, it's too high. But this sadhu seemingly stays in his kutir, in his little cottage, and he goes into a state of cosmic consciousness, puts his body into a metal box to protect it from the elements and the animals, and then in his astral body spends the winter months with Babaji. And this is how he presented himself. So we went to see him. It was up 12,000 feet. We up from Badrinath temple per se. And he had this little kutir, this little cottage with a window that just looked out at the Himalayas. And it was quite an experience. And he happened to be, he doesn't speak English, so we had to have a translator, but he was also in silence. So he just wrote on a slate board and our guide would translate and tell us what he was saying. And we all sort of sat around on the floor and he was sitting on what was actually his bed, which was also the dais. It was a very small place. We saw the box. It was all there. And it was very impressive and extraordinarily evocative of who knows what. So I was just transported by the whole experience. Then afterwards, Swami was living in Delhi at the time, and we came down from the mountain and we went to Delhi and we were staying with Swami. And he asked me, what did I think? What was my impression of Boxwala Baba? And I told him that there were so many forces going at me at the same time that my consciousness was definitely changed, but I could not say where it came from. And then as a question mark about the Baba, I said to Swami, he spoke so casually about just leaving his body and spending the winter with Babaji. He just made it seem like it was just the most natural thing in the world to do. And to my mind, that was like, that diminished his credibility. That was how I was presenting it. Swami said this, well, at a certain point, it simply is natural. I thought, wow, isn't that interesting? He's right. It's not, by the time it's your consciousness, you don't have any words for it. It's just who you are. And we imagine from our state where it isn't natural to us, we give it all this dimension of exoticness. We should respect it, but it's not exotic. It's perfectly natural. It's like when the journalist said to Mother Teresa of Calcutta, people say you're a saint. What do you think of that? And I don't know what they expected her to say back. Something like, oh no, not me, absolutely not, or whatever they wanted. You know, she just said back, yes, and why aren't you a saint? That was her response. Like, what do you think you were born for? You know? And that was just because it was natural to her. I mean, whether she was or wasn't a saint, but the things that she was doing that caused them to deem her a saint, she just thought they were perfectly natural. And I had to finish this. It was either that same trip or somewhat later. I was sitting there talking to a group of devotees in Bangalore. I was having a small satsang in Bangalore. It was the first time I'd visited there. I was meeting most of these people for the first time. They were asking me about various things, and I was telling them the story, much of what I was telling yesterday. I met Swamiji. I knew who he was to me. I extricated myself from everything else that I was doing in my life, and I went to live at Ananda. I was 23, just 20, moving to 24 when I went. They said to me, what did your parents think? I said, I'm an American. That's the first thing I said. Then I said, I didn't ask them. And I then said, and it wouldn't have mattered. Now, that wasn't just cultural. It was just, that was just what was true. And there was this huge Twitter, oh, Masu, you didn't ask your parents, you know, like this, because it was so out of the context. And also I could see it was exotic to make such a move without asking my parents, to make such a move at all. But it didn't seem the least bit exotic to me, which is perfectly natural. Of course, that's what I would have done. And then I remembered how all the pieces go together. So where I'm coming to, which is also part of this, which is when we commit ourselves to a certain way of life, it just becomes who we are. So what we're trying to do with our intuition is the opposite of trying to develop, you know, some kind of powers that are like really separate. What we're really trying to do is we're trying to become so integrated in our commitment to live from a deep and calm center that it doesn't occur to us that this is unusual. You see, this is what I saw in Swamiji. In a certain context with Swamiji, something happened, and he was needing certain other people to sort of move with him, go with him in the direction that he wanted to go. And he was saying, he mentioned to me, he said, this person is having trouble. And then Swami said, I'm completely accustomed to following my heart, is how Swami put it. He said, and they're just learning. And so they just didn't have the same comfort in just going. And this is what I'd said yesterday about how Swamiji doesn't have to calculate where his intuition is taking him. When he said follow his heart, he meant follow his deep, calm, clear heart, not the ripples of feeling that I've mentioned so many times that really confuse us. Even if Swami just has a glimmer of it, he knows that that's what he should follow. See, this is sometimes what happens, and I'm depends on who you're talking to when you're talking to a psychic. A woman came to me and she was torn between her ambitions in the world and her call to the spiritual path, and she chose her ambitions to the world. And she told me that she'd gone to a certain psychic And the psychic had told her, you know, that you have to have a big career. And then after you have a big career, then you can think about God, basically. And she presented this to me as evidence. I said, for heaven's sakes, you walked in there with that desire radiating from every pore of your being. You know, she read you. I said, that's the difference between a psychic and a saint, which is a saint knows which one of the many inner voices is the one that will take you to true happiness. A psychic just reads who you are. And that can still be helpful. That can still be very helpful because it can help you find out who you are. But you have to be very careful about how you follow that and what kind of credence you give. So when Swamiji says he's accustomed to following his heart, he's had enough life experience to be able to know. And here's a very interesting thing. For many of you know that Swami Kriyananda was expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship in 1962. The catalyzing event of that expulsion, although it would have happened anyway, it was God's will, and it was an incompatibility between him and those that Master had left in charge. It was Master's plan. But the catalyzing event was Swamiji's exceedingly bold plans to build a temple to Master in the heart of the city of New Delhi, with the capital of India, in 1962, which was what, barely like 14 years after India had had independence, when the capital was the defining force in the whole country. There were many reasons why it was a brilliant idea. And he went so far as to get Prime Minister Nehru himself to donate land for the temple. It was a miracle. It was just remarkable. But it was way too much for the people 10,000 miles away who just couldn't, who didn't have the capacity to be as bold as he was and had great suspicion of his motives. So it all blew up in his face and never happened. So Swami told us that story many, many times. And then after 10 or 15 years, he added another really interesting little point. He said, when he decided to carry on the campaign to try to get that temple built, he said he didn't actually feel Master's approval. He said he didn't feel his disapproval, but he didn't have the usual sense of moving with Master with him. So he thought, well, I'll experiment and see what happens when I go forward without that feeling. Isn't that interesting? Now, many factors about that are interesting. Swami actually finally said he felt Master withheld his support inwardly because Master knew it was going to be a disaster. And Swami said, I think Master didn't want me to feel that he'd led me into it. And so that was another, you know, nuance that Swami added later. But what I thought was, my gosh, what courage. Which is, well, I need to understand, so I'm just going to experiment and see, and I'll find out. He said, I couldn't think of anything else to do. I didn't want to do nothing, and I couldn't think of anything else to do. So I tried this and succeeded. And, you know, I think there's too many divine mysteries. I'm not going to draw a clean, bright line around it. It's only relevant for this. Swami was willing to experiment. And willing to be wrong, perfectly willing to be wrong. And so when I'm talking about act on what you have, you can't just wait for it all to be clear because it will never come clear. And you have to express a little bit of courage. And you have to have the experiences. You have to have the experiences of what it feels like when the flow works out correctly, what it feels like when it goes wrong. You know, what the nuances are, what goes wrong. There was a project at Ananda back, I don't know, it was been in the 70s. And different ones of us were taking turns being responsible for a certain fundraising effort. We were collectively fundraising. And I was put in charge, and I just wanted to do better than anyone else. I mean, I'm trying to find a way not to embarrass myself, but I can't. There is no way not to embarrass myself. I got personally involved. You know, they did well and I was going to do better. And I bombed. I absolutely bombed. And that was the wonderful time. And, you know, by the time I was bombing, it just, I was out of it. You know, it wasn't my constant need to do that, but it was sufficiently often that it interrupted. And afterwards, when it hadn't worked out, Swami just said to me, "Oh, Asha," he said it sort of like this, "Oh, Asha, whenever your ego gets involved, you make terrible decisions." But I hadn't like boldly gone forward like Swami did to experiment. I'd had an impulse. I tried it, but it didn't work. And as a result, I was able to reverse engineer it, so to speak, and observe my attitudes and remember the vibrations, so that the next time and the next time I was standing on that same fine line between some inspiration and some ego, I would remember what it felt like. But how could we ever know what it feels like unless we actually experience it? So on one hand, as I've spoken of, is the law of prosperity. If you don't make use of what you have, why would the universe give you more? If you dissipate what you have, why would the universe give you more? But we also, this is like, well, Swami put it elsewhere in another book I'm working from. He said, intuition is a muscle. And in order to strengthen it, it has to be exercised. So when we feel a little bit of intuitive guidance, or just even just a little bit of feeling in our heart that this is a way to go, then we need to just put ourselves out into it, see how it works. And one of the instructions, one of the 22 points that Swami has in there is, don't then go and immediately throw yourself off a cliff. He said, take a step, look around, see what it feels like. Swamiji set an example for us, which was, he was exceedingly bold and courageous and visionary, and he had big energy, and he would take big leaps, but he never took a foolish one, and he also never put all his eggs in one basket. He always had a little bit in reserve, and it wasn't out of cowardice. It was out of common sense, and it was also out of respect, and this is something I talked about earlier, out of respect for the possibility that he was wrong. So we didn't just say, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to burn all my bridges and try it. He would take a couple of steps forward, look around, sort of see how it was going, check in with his intuition, see how it felt. Famously, I say famously because it was part of Ananda history, when we were trying to incorporate Ananda as a California city, Ananda Village as a California city, because the municipality had control over its own land use, and we were under the jurisdiction of the county, and we had too much opposition from our neighbors, and it just wasn't working for us. So for 18 months, I and two other women, who were both attorneys as it happened, worked full-time trying to succeed in making Ananda California City. In the end, we were totally defeated. The story is told in Swami Kriyananda, as we've known him, and also in Lightbearer. We're totally defeated. But we were our rights were violated because we were defeated on religious grounds. And the state attorney and the county attorney had told the decision-making board that they could not take our religion into account. It was a violation of our rights. And the entire public hearing was about our religious practices. So we felt that we'd been robbed. We were going to go to court. We were going to stand up for our rights like this. And then 2 days later, Swami just dropped the whole project. The details of it, I don't have time to share, but it was marvelous. He did it in front of a television camera, and that was the first I heard about it. And so I had to turn on a dime and suddenly support Swami in front of the television cameras. And they were from Sacramento. They interview a lot of politicians. They didn't notice that 5 minutes earlier, I had a totally different story. I just flipped my story. Finally, then I go back to Swami like, "Sir," and he sort of smiled. He said, "There was no way to reach you. There were no telephones, you know, like this." And he said, I was meditating and I asked Master what we should do. And Master said, you've done enough. Don't go any farther. I said, I was the one in charge of this project. Why didn't Master tell me? Swami said, did you ask? I said, no. I just presumed. He favored it yesterday. Why would I ask him this morning? And then that was, I mean, there was, Swami didn't have to say anything else. That was the whole story. Oh, I just presumed. I took my intuition and I made dogma out of it instead of keeping it receptive and open. And it wasn't just a question of every 5 minutes I have to ask Master if, you know, you wanted me to eat this bite of oatmeal. Should I eat the next one? You know, it's not like you have to be like that. The asking Master Swami was talking about was an attitude. It was an attitude. Because actually the truth is Swami didn't say, Master, what shall we do? Swami was just receptive. And he heard Master's voice. But if you don't act, then you have nothing to ask, and then we'll never grow. So, my friends, that's my suggestions for today. God bless you.